All right. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for having me. So as David said, I'll tell you about spin slush in an extended spin ice model. This is work done in collaboration with our organizer, Michelle Gingras, at the University of Waterloo. So let me give you a very sort of lightning overview of spin ice. So we heard a little bit about it in the morning, a little more detail than I'm going to go into on spin ice itself. So the simplest model for spin ice is a nearest neighbor Ising antiferromagnet on a pyrochlore lattice. So this is the pyrochlore lattice. It's composed of corner sharing tetrahedra. And usually in materials, these Ising variables are spins, these arrows here that point in or out of the tetrahedron. So to avoid drawing these arrows all the time, I'm going to indicate the spins by either a solid or an open circle. So on this tetrahedron, a filled circle is going out. For this one, that same filled circle is going in. So nearest neighbor Ising antiferromagnet looks like this. As we've heard already, this has a pretty special form. Basically, you can write it as the square of the total spin on each of these tetrahedra, summed over all tetrahedra. So this makes sort of solving for the ground state very easy. You just want all of these total spins, these charges, to be zero. I've added this little factor here to account for the fact that whether it's in or out depends on which tetrahedra we're looking at. So all the ground states have these, all of the Q variables being zero. And what that tells us is that two of the spins point in, two of them point out, right? And there's a macroscopic number of ways to do this, right? If I specify one of these states here, I still have a degree of freedom to pick here and here and here and here. So this manifests itself as some kind of macroscopic residual entropy at very low temperature, something on the order of 0.202 per spin. So, you know, it's a decent reduction, but there's still a macroscopic number of degrees of freedom. So one simulates this. This is some classical model. You can basically solve it numerically. You find this is a good representation of a classical spin liquid, basically all the way down to zero temperature. So this is sort of a rough overview of the ground state properties. One is also interested in the excited state properties, right? So the ground state has Q equals zero. The excited states have Q not equals zero. So I'm going to be drawing lots of pictures like this throughout this talk. So let me just outline the notation a bit. So when this Q is plus or minus one, these are the lowest lying excitations, I'll draw a colored circle inside the tetrahedron. So again, here you see there's three white circles, one black. That's a positive charge on that kind of tetrahedron. Over here on the other sublattice, this red circle is a negative charge, three in, one out. You can also have double charges where all the spins are the same sign. I'll use a slightly bigger circle for that. So while these excitations cost energy, once you sort of pay the cost for these defects, you create a pair costing some energy 4j. They're basically free to move at that point, right? So I make this pair. I pay the energy cost. Now, if you look, if I flip this spin, I hop this monopole to the next tetrahedron. And I can proceed to do that and pull these guys basically as far apart as I'd like. So these charges, these defects, are sort of deconfined once you create them. And they leave behind a sort of string of flipped spins. Okay, so what kind of physics is sort of intrinsic to this spin ice manifold? So a really productive way to think about it is in terms of a sort of coarse grain model, where we write everything in terms of a sort of spatially coarse-grained magnetization field, which I'm going to call B. And the sort of free energy density of this thing is essentially some term penalizing finite B, and then some term here which penalizes the divergence of B, right? And you can think of the divergence here as basically being the number of arrows going in minus the number of arrows going out of a given tetrahedron. Now, if we go to low temperature, the coefficient of this term diverges, and so you basically constrain this div B to be zero. Right, so this is like regular, you know, magnetostatics, right? This is the sort of coarse-grained version of the ice rules. Now, this has a lot of interesting implications, the sort of most striking of which is that it implies that the correlations in these coarse-grained magnetization fields obeys sort of power law relations, sort of looks like dipolar form. And you can see this very strikingly in probes like, you know, the structure factor, where it manifests as these sharp, singular, pinch point-like features. You know, when there's a finite density of these charges, this also mediates a kind of Clum interaction between the charges that's entropic, which I won't go into too much. Okay, one more feature I want to point about SpinICE before we go into the meat of the talk is that if you think about this as a classical system, the dynamics becomes very slow at low temperature. So this is true even in the simple nearest neighbor model. Basically, you can think about it as, if I go to flip this one spin, I always create a pair of charges. This always costs some energy of order J. And so there's some Arrhenius-like behavior, activated-like behavior, suppressing the creation of these charges. So what this means is that as you lower and lower the temperature, the ability to move out of given ice states becomes harder and harder. Right? And you can see here, you know, this is some measure of the sort of time-dependent correlations here, is that they grow exponentially as you go down in temperature. This is the sort of autocorrelation time, and you can see as I lower the temperature, it shoots up. Right? So for practical purposes, that means once you get below a certain temperature, that scale is going to surpass any reasonable human time scale, and then the system is essentially frozen. Further, this freezing, because flipping any spins creates the same pair of monopoles, at least when we're talking about this nearest neighbor model, this freezing is completely homogeneous. So this relaxation behavior is essentially independent of the site. Okay, so SpinICE has realizations. Again, as we heard this morning, these are dipolar SpinICEs, where the long-range dipole-dipole interactions are important. But qualitatively, the features are quite similar. So, you know, there's all these things that I mentioned have been confirmed in experiment. You see here this residual entropy, roughly of the right value. You see these pinch points and neutron scattering. You see this exponential, or at least very fast growing relaxation time. This is super exponential, but the basic idea holds. So that's the last piece of experiment I'm going to tell you about now. So the rest of the talk is going to be about theoretically extending and trying to modify this SpinICE. So how do we extend it? So one natural set of perturbations that shows up in materials is further neighbor exchanges, right? And so this could be through super exchange, this could be through other mechanisms, but usually aside from just the nearest neighbor term, you'll generate second neighbor and third neighbor terms. So the model I'm going to consider is essentially, I'm going to add a second neighbor term and a third neighbor term. And by third neighbor, I mean that second and third neighbor, I mean the bonds that are two nearest neighbor steps away from a given site. So these red bonds here are the nearest neighbor bonds. Then these guys here, if you follow, you can see that they're each two steps away along nearest neighbor bonds. So are these guys. There's a, if you do in terms of Euclidean distance, there's another kind of third neighbor that I won't get into. So if you add these guys to SpinICE, generically you'll lift the degeneracy, right? So when you just have J, no J2 or J3, you have this macroscopic degeneracy, right? And classically, that's in some sense unstable, right? If I just picked random values for these, you'll just pick out some state from that manifold. So that's a little boring. So we're going to try to evade that a little bit, and it turns out you can. So there's a special regime in parameter space. Basically, if you make these two guys equal to each other, second neighbor coupling and this third neighbor coupling, which I'm going to call J prime from now on, you can write the energy like this. So basically, this is just like classical SpinICE, right? We want to get these charges to be zero, just with a different coefficient here. And then there's additionally this term here, which is an attraction between charges of the same sign that are on nearest neighbor tetrahedra. So if I just add this very small J prime, it's still SpinICE at a low enough temperature. We're going to look at what happens as we crank it up, right? If you look at this guy here, something drastic is going to happen when this changes sign, right? You know, if this becomes negative, it's not going to want zero anymore. But it turns out something more interesting happens before that happens. So let me draw your attention to this plot here, which is basically the energies of the excitations in SpinICE, right? So this doesn't split the degeneracy of the ice manifold, but it does lift the degeneracy of the states containing these monopoles. So in nearest neighbor SpinICE, these are essentially free. Now that we've added this term here, the like charges want to attract to each other, right? So if I take this energy here, which would be just arbitrary two monopoles for nearest neighbor SpinICE, if I start turning on this J prime, then you see the states where the oppositely charged monopoles are far apart go down, where there's a cost to putting two oppositely charged monopoles together, right? And you can come up with, you know, larger constructions here. You see, you know, having two that are opposite next to each other costs energy, but putting the same sign charges, you gain this attraction. So that goes down. So these all start coming down, right? But until they cross zero, spin ice is still the ground state. So it turns out the set of states that crosses zero first is very interesting. So an example is here, where we've, you know, the smallest size structure is, you know, sets of six charges or a double charge and four single charges. So what happens when this, what is the state at this end point? So this state, this set of states turns out to be an infinite set of states, not just some set of monopoles, but a new macroscopically large set of states. And you can see that very easily if you sort of rearrange the model a little bit. So I'm going to put it right at this end point, which is J prime equals J over 4. I'm going to sort of sit at this end point for the rest of the talk. And you can write it in a way that's very qualitatively similar to the spin ice case. Basically, instead of having a total charge on a pair of tetrahedra, squaring that and summing over, instead of having total charge on a single tetrahedra, summing that over all tetrahedra, now it's pairs. Okay, so we want this object here, this sort of new kind of charge, to be minimal, right? But it's sort of, there's a fundamental difference here, right? Instead of being four sites for tetrahedra, and that can be zero, this is seven, which means it sort of has to be non-zero fundamentally. So with this normalization here, this guy can be either plus or minus a half. So this manifold is bigger than that of spin ice. You can show specifically that all of the spin ice states lie within this new manifold, but it also includes an entirely new set of states which extend that of spin ice. Okay. So what are these states? What is this manifold? What is the analog of this two-in, two-out rule from spin ice for this end point? Okay, so it's a little more complicated. It's not just, you can't just say two-in, two-out anymore. And you have to phrase it in terms of these spin ice charges. So the sort of simplest way to write it down is this. You can put down, I'm going to put down a bunch of charges. I'll specify the rules for doing that. And then the remainder of the sites, I fill in with any ice rules obeying states I like. So first thing I can do is I can put down single charges, so long as their minority spin is on another charge of the same sign. So for example, this is a single charge. Here it's three white, one black. The minority spin has to belong to a tetrahedra with a charge of the same sign. Okay, that's that rule. It could also lie in a double charge. The second rule tells you how to place these double charges. Basically says they have to be surrounded by single charges, again, with their minority spins lying on the double charge. And one minor one that won't come up so much is that you can't have opposite charges right next to each other. Okay, so this is a new manifold, a whole new set of states with these strange sort of charge structures to it, right? You have these sort of almost methane-like double charge things and these branching structures of single charges. What does this model do? Does it have as rich finite temperature physics, as rich magnetic correlations as spin ice? The answer is sort of. I'd say yes. I'll leave it up to you. So it also is a classical spin liquid for all temperatures. So this is specific heat, for example, no features. The entropy, if you compute it, is a good chunk higher than spin ice, as we should expect. No evidence of any ordering. There's an estimate of the entropy. And sort of like spin ice, there's also evidence that you know, sort of naive simulations freeze at low temperature. Just like in spin ice, there's some slowing down of the dynamics because of these kind of energy barriers between the states. I'll come back to that. But first, let's go into the magnetic properties. So spin ice had pinch points. What does this have? In the structure factor, there's these interesting sort of spherical structures with some characteristic length scale. So this is some sort of intermediate length. It's not small. It's not like one tetrahedra, but it's not long either. It's on the scale of maybe two cubic unit cells, roughly the size of these weird charge structures we were looking at. So here, this is what you would see in a neutron scattering experiment. If you look at something like the correlations between the charges themselves, it actually looks quite a bit cleaner, which you see here. So you see these nice circles of high intensity, kind of reminiscent of a liquid. So these are not just 2D. So this is in some plane of reciprocal space. They're actually sort of spheres, very close to being spheres of high intensity, Right, so here I've taken one of those circles and I've shown you a bit of the third dimension. So you can understand this from the same kind of coarse grained picture you have for spin ice. So in spin ice, I'm going to ignore that b squared term and that I wrote. I'll just look at the terms that have derivatives in them. You can partially understand it. So this was the term that you have in spin ice, right? So when beta went to infinity in force, that div b was zero. This was the ice rules. Now, if you work out the same theory, but for this extended spin ice, at this what you find is you get an additional correction to this term that's negative. There's a 6 there, but that's not particularly important. So what you find is that if you make this j prime large enough, you go far enough along this line, this thing changes sign, right? So this is sort of an instability, right? You have a coefficient that's going, blowing up with t, and so you know you need to go to higher order, basically. You need to include these quartic terms. So up to this, j prime is j over 6, still spin ice. At this point, that changes sign, and you have to consider higher order terms. So in momentum space, it looks something like this. So I've turned the div into this k. Now the coefficient's negative at this endpoint, right? So if we include some quartic terms, you basically get a sort of Mexican hat potential, right? And so the div dot b in momentum space is sort of constrained the line along a surface, right? And that's sort of roughly where these spheres of intensity are coming from. And this is the analogy of the sort of coarse-grained ice constraint. Okay, so those are the magnetic correlations. Let me go into a bit of the freezing. So as I said, at low temperature, spin ice freezes, so does this. Qualitatively, are they the same or are they different? They're quite different. So this is a plot from a simple Monte Carlo simulation of the autocorrelation time. So this sort of spreading out as you go down in temperature, this slowing down of the dynamics is what you see in spin ice. But here you see it's not exactly a nice exponential. So a nice exponential will be sort of flat and come down. Here it comes down early, and you can't fit it with a single exponential with a single time. Further, I've also shown here some traces. These thin lines are the autocorrelation functions for single sites, and they spread out much, much faster than they do in spin ice. So the slowing down, the dynamics, is actually slowing down heterogeneously rather than homogeneously. So you can really make this crisp if you look at very, very low temperature. So if we look at 10 to the minus 4 in temperature, what you find is that there's a whole bunch of spins that are completely static, completely frozen, but then a whole bunch of other spins, again, somewhat randomly distributed spatially, that are very dynamic, that have very short autocorrelation times. This is very sort of extreme heterogeneity, that word, in time. On some sites they're of order 1, on some sites they're arbitrarily long. And further, the long time values of these, which basically represent the sort of local magnetization, tend to cluster on squares of simple fractions. So where is this all coming from? So in some attempt to understand this, let me show you what a low temperature simulation in this thing actually looks like, if I can find my cursor. So what I'm showing you here is one of these spin slush states. And what's happening is all the sites that aren't highlighted in yellow are frozen, where the sites that are highlighted in yellow at a given time step are dynamic. So this is all happening within the manifold of this endpoint. So these are all ground states, but they can remain dynamical. And you see these structures can move and rearrange, and it's a big mess. Okay, so what exactly is happening here? So it turns out that within this manifold, there are sets of states, small clusters of states, that remain dynamical. You can understand sort of on a first principles basis, right? So one of these is here. So suppose I took this guy here, a double charge surrounded by single charges and a little protrusion here. This satisfies all those rules that I told you about. And if you look at the middle spin, I don't know if you can see it, but if you could look and see the actual values of the spin, you convince yourself if you flip this spin, it wouldn't violate any of this spin, this endpoint condition on any of these pairs of tetrahedra. Right, another way to see it is, if these guys all satisfy it, then this reflection satisfies all the rules as well, right? So you can think of it just moving this double charge back and forth, right? And this can happen at arbitrary low temperature, right? And so this kind of dynamics would happen in sort of order 1 time rather than this exponentially long time scale. You can also construct more complicated clusters. Here's one that involves three sites where I can take this red charge, move it over here, and then move it over here, and then go randomly back and forth. So this one's particularly interesting because this guy is flipping between up and down. The three states these guys are flipping between have a net magnetization. So at long times, you basically get the net magnetization of this thing squared, which tells you where these simple fractions are coming from. You can make these arbitrarily complicated. Maybe I didn't say it, but this is why we call it spin slush. Is basically you have these spins that are completely frozen, and then these other spins that are very, very dynamical that are localized. Right? So you have frozen region, which is like water ice, and then liquid parts as well. So this is a spin version of that. So these little clusters might be more predominant. They might be easier to form, but you can also just construct larger ones, right? So this double charge hopping around that I looked at can also be, just lengthened arbitrarily, right? So this double charge can now go across the whole chain, right? And you can build analogs of the other thing as well, where this single charge can just move up and down, right? These are just the things you can write down by hand, right? This one is for different types of dynamics too, right? So this would be for flipping a spin. This is exchanging spins, right? So it's sort of robust that there are these clusters that can still move around even at very low temperatures. Okay, so what does this mean? So there are sort of direct implications of this low temperature dynamics for what happens when you perturb the model, especially with terms that induce quantum effects. So up to this point, everything's completely classical, right? But you can imagine including something like a weak transverse field or a weak transverse exchange and ask what it does to this state. So in spin ice, this leads to quantum spin ice. But this only appears at third order for this guy and sixth order for this guy in perturbation theory, right? Basically, because of the same reasons you have these dynamical, long dynamical timescales, right? When you flip a spin in spin ice, you have to create these two monopoles, right? The tunnel between the states, you have to go through a few states that, cost finite energy. Here, you don't, right? Because you can flip a spin and stay within the ground state manifold, it means that the quantum terms can have effects even at first order. So this could be quite a bit stronger. What exactly this does, we don't know. But it could be particularly interesting, especially if the state could be some kind of quantum spin liquid. Okay, so that's the end. So we've introduced a new kind of classical spin liquid on the power core lattice. The ground states have this complicated charge structure, which I showed you how to construct. It exhibits this heterogeneous dynamics at low temperature, and there could be some interesting quantum effects. Just to make a very brief, very tentative statement, how does this relate to anything real, right? You could look at, moving away from this point and adding additional perturbations. If you do, you can find phases like that are magnetically ordered. For example, a phase with a half ordering vector, which might be related to some of these power core materials. If you want details, we have a preprint on the archive. There's also independent work which studied a similar model, which you can look at as well for a slightly different take on it. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for some questions.
So given that you have these clusters that can be quite extended and somewhat complicated, would you expect this system to be very sensitive to quench disorder that would tend to pin the dynamics of whatever it was that could be moving around in it?
So if there's disorder in the dynamical clusters, it could break them up very easily, right? Especially even not disorder, even just perturbations. The first thing to go will be the long clusters, right? They'll go fastest, which is true of anything really. Like if I perturb spin ice with some other perturbation, the more random ice states are the ones that shoot up in energy faster. Yeah. Right? These are the more complex states are the ones that'll go first.
So if you had an easing spin glass with plus minus J interactions, would that also be slushy in that sense? that some sites experience zero net exchange fields and others don't.
Right, so you're saying if you have plus minus J, some fraction of the sites, the exchange field will vanish. And
right.
Yeah. This is disorder free, which is different. This is, yeah. You're right that in a glassy system, you might, with that kind of discrete disorder, you could easily get something like this. You can get this, like if you have a triangular latticizing model, right, that's completely dynamic. Right, so I think the neat part about this is the fact that it's disorder free and that it's both has these frozen regions and the dynamic regions.
And you showed this effective theory with the Lifshitz transition.
Yeah.
Is there any chance you could add some noise and turn this into a Langevin equation, or is that too coarse grained to see these effects?
Okay, so I skipped a bit of the coarse graining. So it only sort of partially accounts for it. So it can account for, did I lose it? Where'd it go? There it is. So in spin ice, this coarse grain theory works very well. Here, it works less so. So, right, this Lifshitz transition is at J over 6, where in the Ising model, it only, it's spin ice up till J over 4. Further, if you actually look at low temperature, so if you, you know, study this equation, what you'll find is that you get a perfectly sharp surface as you go towards T equals 0, right? But in if you actually compute it in the Ising model, the width of these shells remains, you know, it freezes, so it's hard to tell completely, but it doesn't look like it's sharpening. Short answer is, I don't know about the Langevin thing, but it's not clear that this would accurately represent the Ising case.
Any additional questions?
So while you've got the structure factor on here, if a neutron scatterer was to measure something like this, they would immediately associate the wave vector at which you see the shell with the wave, you know, 2 pi over the wavelength of some sort of structure. And would that make sense to do?
Okay, so this is a bit tentative. Like if you just, okay, so if you, this is roughly the size. So this is the, A is the cubic size. So you're talking about roughly 2 cubic unit cells.
Okay, oh, and that's is this where the association with half-half-half comes in, or is that something else?
That's something else. So the half-half-half state is one of these spin slush states. It's in the ground state manifold. So if you perturb away from it, you can easily pick it, where it's not an ice state. I just fit it numerically. It's basically from, if you look at this coarse grain theory, you can figure out where you get the size from. But you know, one way to interpret it, again, we haven't really felt it out to see if it's completely robust, is if you look at these charge structures, right, and they appear for, if you pick a random one of these states, you'll get a bunch of these charge structures. Even the smallest ones of them occupy roughly 1 or 2 cubic cells. So it might have something to do with that. That's sort of tentative, though.
OK, any additional questions? If not, let's thank Jeff one more time.